It's just a couple of calls. First of all, I want to emphasize Samuel's attitude towards Saul. Somebody said, okay, you burned your bridges, you brought this on yourself, it's your fault, and have this type of attitude toward them. But if you look at chapter
15, when the Lord appears to him and tells him what Saul has done, how he has disobeyed God, we read that in verse 11, where Samuel was angry and he cried unto Jehovah all night. We emphasized before that Samuel, from a youth, served and ministered to the Lord all of his life. And how he brought about a national repentance and how he led the people to choose a king. And so his number one concern has been the children of Israel. And now this happens to him. You come over to chapter 15. Said in verse 33, Samuel says, verse 34 is what I'm after. And Samuel went to Ramah, and Saul went to his house in Gibeah of Saul. They went their separate ways. And Samuel came no more to see Saul until the day of his death. Now, I think this is a very interesting statement. Because you go to chapter 28 and you read of the witch of Endor conjuring up Samuel. Did he really appear? But as you read this verse, it says he did not see him until the day of his death. Samuel saw Saul. I think this helps to clarify a lot of the confusion. But coming back to our verses, for Samuel mourned for Saul. The word is he grieved for Saul. For Jehovah repented that he had made Saul king over Israel. And then the 16th chapter, the first verse. Jehovah said unto Samuel, how long will you mourn? That is, how long will you grieve for Saul? Seeing I have rejected him from being king over Israel, fill your horn with oil, and I will send you to Jesse the Bethlehemite, for I have provided me a king among his sons. But again, the idea is he grieved. I think this shows a tender, compassionate heart on the part of Samuel. And it's an attitude that just seemed to characterize him throughout his life. Instead of saying, it's good enough for you, you brought it on yourselves, there's nothing I can do for you, he wept and he grieved over Saul. Now, before we get into chapter 16, I want to go back to chapter 13. This is where Saul has offered the sacrifice, which he shouldn't have done, and he said in verse 12, I'll force myself to do it. In verse 14, Samuel said, but now your kingdom shall not continue. Jehovah has sought him a man after his own heart. And you come over to chapter 15. Again, when Saul is wanting Samuel to go with him. In verse 28, that chapter 15, verse 28, Samuel said unto him, Jehovah has rent the kingdom of Israel from you this day, and has given it to a neighbor of yours that is better than you. And so as we have these two references to the king that is to follow, we now come to chapter 16. And in chapter 16, there's about 15 different things that's told us concerning David. First of all, I don't have it on the chart here, but we find that he's a son of Jesse, a Bethlehemite, that I don't have on our chart. But he was the youngest of eight brothers, as you look at chapter 16, verse 10 and 11. He was a shepherd, as you look at verse 11. And of course, as we think of David as a shepherd, our thoughts almost immediately go to Psalm 23, where Jehovah is my shepherd, I shall not want. He leads me beside still waters. He makes me to lie down in green pastures. And so here's David the shepherd. And these are thoughts then that we've been going through his mind. I like this, he's like me. Anyway, he was ruddy, don't laugh. He was ruddy, that is, he had reddish hair. And I think this would be interesting, I'd love to have seen it, because the Israelites were dark-headed. And here is one that his hair evidently is a little different. It is reddish. He has a beautiful countenance, as the American Standard Translation states it. Many of your translations says he has fair eyes. This is the term that's used back in Genesis chapter 29, verse 17, when it's comparing Leah and Rachel. It said that Leah had weak eyes. Doesn't mean she needed to wear glasses. But her eyes weren't bright and lustrous as Rachel's was. And so this is the term then that's used to describe David. He had fair eyes. They were bright. They were lustrous. They were dark eyes. Again, the translation in the term in some of your translations says he was handsome. The American Standard says he was goodly to look upon. And that is, he had a pleasant appearance about him. The next thing that we read is the Spirit of God came upon him from that hour whenever he received the anointing from Samuel. I believe there's a division someplace here in the chapter. I'm not quite sure where it is. And so I've arbitrarily put the division right here. He was skillful at playing the lyre. You get to the latter part of the chapter, and here's where he is called upon to play the lyre before Saul. Just jumping ahead just a little. In chapter 15, as the children of Israel fighting the Philistines, in verse 15 it says, now David went to and fro from Saul to feed his father's sheep at Bethlehem. So in chapter 16, the servants of Saul call upon David to play the lyre before him. And you get to chapter 15 that David is going back and forth. Now this is an interesting point, because after David fights Goliath, the children of Israel are victorious in the battle. You look at chapter 15 and verse 57. And as David returned from the slaughter of the Philistines, this is chapter 17, verse 57, Abner took him and brought him before Saul, and the head of the Philistines was in his hand, and Saul said to him, whose son are you, you young man? Now, there's three terms that's used in chapter 17 to describe David. One is a youth. One is a stripling, as it is in the American Standard Translation. And this term, young man, you go to Isaiah chapter 7, verse 14, about the virgin that shall conceive and bear a son. This is the masculine form of Alma, virgin, which would indicate that he is a grown individual. As I suggest, there's three different terms used here, but we have difficulty with all of them. And so what it is, actually going back up to a few verses, when Saul, this is chapter 17, verse 55, when Saul saw David go forth against the Philistines, he said to Abner, the captain of the host, Abner, whose son is this? I was saying, duh, he's been playing the harp for you all this time. Well, he could have had an acquaintance with David, but this is what he's asking. He's asking about his heritage. He's asking about his family. Who is your father? Where are you from? What is your financial condition? What influence do you have in the community? I used to think that there's a problem here, because David's been going back and forth to Saul, and then after he defeats him, Saul turns to Abner and says, who is this guy? Well, he's not asking, who is David? He's asking about his family. But coming back to the continued point that's called our attention in chapter 16, he was brave, he was valiant. Now, he proves this in chapter 17. And that's why I feel that what the author of the First Samuel, author of the book of First Samuel, is doing is he's projecting into the future and drawing other attributes and clumping them all together. I'd emphasize when we started our study in the book of First Samuel that it's not all written in chronological order. And so here's we're having the attributes of David call to our attention. One points out the fact that he's a valiant, or he's brave, or he's valiant, which he proved in chapter 17. He was a man of war. He proves this in chapter 18. So again, I see an indication that the author of the book of 1 Samuel is reaching out into the future and drawing these attributes as he looks at David. He is eloquent in speech. Some of them said, well, he's eloquent, he's skillful, he's prudent in speech. And once more, as we look at the Psalms that David has written, it's quite obvious, yes, he was eloquent, skillful in speech. An outstanding individual with the ability to express himself with great humility and devotion toward God. Also, another term is, in the American Standard, that he's comely. Once more, it's another term like handsome, going back to chapter 16, verse 12. But this one means something to be gazed at. Now, almost look and consider as he's walking down the street, all the women, they sigh and faint, and they gaze at him. Really, that's what this term means. It's somebody that you would look upon, that you would look at once more. Jehovah was with him in chapter 16, verse 18. Saul loved David. Well, doesn't love him until after he defeats the Philistines, after David is called into Saul's army, and he fights Saul's battles, then Saul loves him. And then finally, verse 21, ran out of space on this slide. In verse 21, he became Saul's armor bearer. Well, again, he didn't become his armor bearer in chapter 16. But again, I believe that he's projecting into the future and drawing all these attributes and all these characteristics of David together. In verse 22 of chapter 16, it said, we have all these attributes of David called to our attention. It said that Saul would not let David return home. But you look at chapter 15 or chapter 17, verse 15, that he's going back and forth from home to Saul. Well, it was in chapter 18 that he wouldn't let David go back home. And I find it interesting in chapter 8, where Samuel's telling them about how the king will be, that he'll take your sons and make them captains over 1,000, captains over 100. He'll make them drive your chariots and run before the chariots and so forth. And sure enough, that's what happens to David. Saul sees him and draws him to himself. All right, as we just very briefly look at chapter 16, any thought, any comment that anybody has on these characteristics, these attributes of David? All right, I was going to emphasize the idea that he had red hair and he was handsome, and so I feel like I can relate to him. I heard some laughter there. All right, with that then, let's go to chapter 17. In chapter 17, the Philistines have marshaled their armies together to fight with Israel. Now, remember there are five lords of the Philistines. They are kings, if you will, over their city-states. And again, you get to chapter 29, where they are mustering or gathering at Aphek to go on up to Jezreel to fight Saul. Their armies are coming together. So in verse 1 of chapter 17, now the Philistines gathered together their armies to battle. There's five armies, five city-states, five kings. And so they've gathered together their armies to battle, and they were gathered together at Soko, which belongs to Judah, and they encamped between Soko and Azekah at Ephraz Danim, or Damon, I believe, in verse 2. And Saul and the men of Israel were gathered together and encamped in the valley of Elah and set battle in array against the Philistines. And the Philistines stood on one mountain on the one side, and Israel stood on the mountain on the other side, and there was a valley between them. Now, coming over to the 50th verse, as David is getting prepared to go meet Saul, it states that, if I could get it, no, that's what was already smitten him with the stone. But David goes and gathers, it's verse 40 that I'm after. And he, that is David, took his staff in his hand and chose him five smooth stones out of the brook and put them in his shepherd's bag. Now, I call this to your attention, first of all, to note, if I don't know where my pointer is. Okay, we can do without it. Azekah is just about due west of Bethlehem over the mountains. And they have gathered themselves at Sokol, and then they come to the region or the mountain. All right. I probably can't hold it steady anyway, but we'll give it a try. All right. Azekah is going to be right in there. And, of course, Bethlehem's over here. And they come to Azekah. And this is where the battle takes place. A very interesting thing. This is a picture of the Valley of Elah, north of Sokol. And so if it is not the spot where the children of Israel fought the Philistines, it is very near the spot where the children of Israel fought the Philistines. The Philistines would be gathered over here. Remember, they gathered at Sokol, and then you read on the next two verses, they were on this mountain, and the children of Israel is on this mountain, and there was a valley in between them. Now, very interesting thing. If you look at that picture, you can see the tree line going through there. That's the brook. And it's still there today. And as you can see, there's cultivation taking place, but there's no cultivation taking where the brook is. And so I believe what we're doing is may not be the exact spot, but we're looking at a spot near where the children of Israel fought against the Philistines. Here's another picture of the same area. Once more, you see the brook right here through these trees. I believe the Philistines were over there. The children of Israel were over here with the valley in between where Goliath came down for 40 days challenging the children of Israel. Very quickly, this is a picture of that brook when it is dry. And this is a picture of the brook during the rainy season. When there's water flowing through the brook. And, of course, you see the mountains on either side. I want to go back to this one. And let's look then at chapter 17. I find it interesting. Goliath defied the armies of Israel. David uses a different term in this chapter. It talks about the army of Jehovah. Coming back to chapter 17, notice if you would in verse 10. See, and the Philistines said, I defy the armies of Israel this day. David doesn't use that term. He uses the term the armies of Jehovah, identifying the army with God, not just with men. But anyway, I defy the armies of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together. And of course, when Saul and the army heard this, they all fled from him. Coming on down to verse 16, it says, and the Philistine drew near morning and evening, and presented himself for 40 days. So for 40 days, he's left the Philistine camp on the other side. He comes down into the valley. He defies the armies of Israel. He wants the Israelites to pick out a champion and fight him. And of course, what he says, if you can defeat me, then we will be your servants. But if I defeat your man, then you become my servants. As you read later on in the chapter, of course, when David does slay Goliath, the Philistines go back on their word. Instead of becoming the servants of the children of Israel, they all flee and head back home. In verse 33, it says that David is a youth. David has been asking, you know, what is going to be done for the man that can defeat the Philistines, and they're going to let him have the king's daughter for marriage, and they're going to set the house free, that is, you'd be free from taxes, tribute, and personal service. Well, excuse me, word of this comes to Saul, and David is called before him. And Saul said to David, you are not able to go against this Philistine to fight him. You are but a youth. Now, this is a general term, because you go to the book of Proverbs chapter 15, Proverbs chapter 5, I should say, the children of Israel are told to rejoice in the wife of your youth. And so as we figure, here's David, only a little boy David, only a babbling brook, and here's this little fellow that's probably less than waist high, and they're supposed to rejoice in the wife of their youth? No, youth can be one that is old enough to be married. Youth can be a term that's young. It's a general term. To me, the closest that we come is the latter part of the chapter when he calls David a young man. And that's the masculine form of Alma. And Alma refers to a grown woman, which would indicate that David then is a grown man. In verse 26, as David is speaking, he said, verse 26, David spoke to the men that stood by him, what shall be done to the man that kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that should defy the armies of the living God? I find that impressive as you look at this chapter. Goliath talks about the armies of Israel. David doesn't talk about the armies of Israel. David recognized that God fights for Israel, and that God uses them as his instruments to accomplish his will. And so David looks at the army, not as an army of men, but as an instrument of God. At the same time, you go down to verse 36. Your servant, as he's speaking to Saul, and Saul says, you can't go fight this Philistine. He talks about he's killed a lion and a bear. And he says, your servant smote both the lion and the bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine shall be as one of them, seeing he has defied the armies of the living God. Again, I just find that impressive. You see the attitude, the disposition that David had. Later, as we get in the 18th chapter, we see that there's affinity between Jonathan and David. Because remember, go back to chapter 14, where Jonathan and his armor bearer goes up and fights the Philistines. It says, God can save by few, or he can save by many. He had confidence in the providential guidance of God. And David evidently has the same in this situation. Any thought before we get further in the chapter? Yes.
You know, thinking about that and some of the attributes that you mentioned of David on the previous slides, you know, thinking about he was a brave man, a valiant warrior, those kind of things. And I think you see his faith and courage here, even in the next verse, in verse 37, you know, when he's talking about when he fought and defeated the lion and the bear, it was the Lord who delivered me, and he will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine. You know, he had enough confidence in what God had done, and he knew God's track record, so to speak. You know, that God really was the power behind anything that he did. And at a very young age, for him to realize that, to me, is just very impressive.
And that's a good point. Because in all of this, David shows a relationship with God. And I oftentimes wonder, oh, go ahead, Kerry.
No, you go ahead, Bishop. Talk.
I was just going to say, I wonder if we, in our lives with our priorities, could say that we have this type of relationship with God that David did. David was confident in his relationship with God, and that confidence came from the life that he lived. With that, I'll hush. Kerry, go ahead.
No, that's a good point. So look at your map. You know, it's kind of amazing that for 40 days, Goliath came down morning and evening. And you imagine two armies sitting here, and 40 days is a long time to have that kind of tactical patience. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It may be hard to wait around for 40 days.
Yeah. 2 points in that. As you read the 17th chapter, there was fighting that took place. And so we don't know where the fighting was, who all was involved in it, but there is fighting that takes place. And the other point is, David is having to take food to his brothers, 40 days. I mean, they've been there a long time. And so he takes food to them. And by the way, he too takes 2 pieces of cheese for the captain. You do favor for him, and maybe he'll do favor for his brothers. But that's a good point. This has been going on for some time. There is some fighting as you read the 17th chapter. And they're being there a long time, food has to be carried to them. Anybody else? By the way, there's one point. Bear with me. We've got to go back to chapter 16. Samuel is in the house of Jesse, and they call Eliab and Abinadab, and I forgot what the name of the third one is. And in verse 6 of 1 Samuel 16, and it came to pass when they were come, and he, that is Samuel, looked on Eliab and said, surely Jehovah's anointed is before him. Now there's a principle in the next verse. All of us are acquainted with it and familiar with it, but I can't pass by without saying something about it. Verse 7, but Jehovah said unto Samuel, look not on his countenance, or on the height of his stature, because I have rejected him, for Jehovah sees not as man sees. For man looks on the outward appearance, but Jehovah looks on the heart. There's a number of passages of Scripture that emphasize this for us. One is in the Gospel of Luke chapter 16, after After Jesus has told the parable of the unprofitable servant, it says, and the Pharisees, who were lovers of money, heard all these things, and they scoffed him. And he said unto them, you are they that justify yourselves in the sight of men, but God knows your hearts. For that which is exalted among men is an abomination in the sight of God. The emphasis is God knows your heart. And you go to Hebrews chapter 4, where it talks about all things are naked and laid open before the eyes of him with whom we have to do. Now, I might be able to deceive the elders of the congregation, the preacher of this congregation, and others of this congregation, and I'm really a hypocritical scoundrel. But I have the ability to pull it off. But all things are naked and laid open before the eyes of him with whom we have to do. God knows your heart. Psalm 39 says that God knows our thoughts afar off. And this is important, because what kind of thoughts occupy our time during the day? Do we think about things spiritual, or do we think about things carnal? Jacob has been emphasizing the works of the flesh, as are mentioned in Galatians chapter 5. Well, the point is, does our mind dwell on this sort of thing? I may be able to fool others, but God knows my heart afar off. 1 Samuel chapter 16 says, men looks on the outward appearance, but Jehovah looks on the heart. Brethren, that ought to scare us and ought to make each one of us step back and look at our lives, the attitudes we have, the priorities we have. God knows our heart. Okay, with that, I get down off my soapbox and we'll go ahead and get back to chapter 17. Any thought, any comment leading up to that, Kurt?
I was just thinking, what type of people do we talk to or associate with? Do we talk to people that are ignorant in the ways of God, or do we talk to people that are striving to get to heaven and encourage us to grow? And I think we should try to be around people with the same goals as we are.
In the Tuesday night men's Bible study class, I'll put a plug in for us. We're studying right now the life of Jehoshaphat. And Jehoshaphat had many outstanding qualities about him, but he had one fault. He aligned himself with Ahab, the king of Israel, and with Ahab's sons. And I think of the passage of scripture that says, be not unequally yoked with unbelievers. He's a good man. But yet he aligned himself with others that didn't share his values. And I think that's what Kurt is emphasizing. Are we associating with people that's going to help us reach our goal? Or are we associating with people that draw us back? 1 Corinthians 15:33, evil companions corrupt good morals. Good point. Anybody else? Yes.
You know, thinking about this verse, I kind of think about King Saul. You know, what was said about his physical appearance, that he was head and shoulders above everybody. I mean, maybe on the outside he looked like a king, whatever picture people have in their mind of who a king should be. Yeah. Even though David was handsome, maybe he wasn't as tall as his older brothers, I don't know. But sometimes we can get caught up in that too. Not necessarily, doesn't have to be things that are sinful, but we can just be so caught up in our physical appearance and physical things that we're more concerned about that than we are, you know, having a heart that's like God's.
You talk about Saul. Remember when Saul first became king, he started out humble. He started out with a good attitude and disposition, but as time passed, that attitude changed to the point that he was so corrupt, God had said, I'm going to get another king. And so, yeah, he started out that way, but he didn't end that way. All right, anybody else? I'm wanting to get to Goliath's comment toward David. Now, what has happened is David has gotten 5 stones, and he's gone down into this valley. And Goliath has come down, and he's looking around. And all he does is see this strapping of an individual in front of him. And so, in verse 41 of chapter 17, and the Philistine came and drew near unto David, and the man that bare the shield went before him. And when the Philistine looked about, you know, is this all there is, just David? He looked about and saw David. He disdained him, that is, he had contempt for him. For he was but a youth, and ruddy, and withal fair countenance. And the Philistine said to David, am I a dog that you come to me with staves? And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. Now, good to note how David responds. But anyway, he cursed David by his gods. And the Philistine said to David, come to me, and I will give your flesh unto the birds of the heaven and to the beasts of the field. That's about the time I would say, okay, discretion is the better part of valor. I think it's time for me to retreat. But David wasn't like me. He gives as good as he can take. Verse 45. Then David said to the Philistine, you come to me with the sword and with the spear and with the javelin, But I come to you in the name of Jehovah of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day will Jehovah deliver you into my hands, and I will smite you. And remember now, Goliath said that I'm going to give your flesh to the birds of the heaven, to the beasts of the field. He said, I will smite you and take your head off of you, and I will give the dead bodies, plural, of the host of the Philistines this day, unto the birds of the heaven and to the wild beasts of the field. And all the earth then will know that there is a God in Israel. And verse 47, and that all this assembly may know that Jehovah saves not by sword or spirit. Again, you go back to chapter 14, to Jonathan, where he expresses the same type of attitude and disposition. I think this is when we get to chapter 18. We see the two of them just melding together because they have the same heart. We look at David and we know him pretty well, but we don't know Jonathan much. But Jonathan was the same heart and soul with him. But anyway, Jehovah saves not by sword and spear, for the battle is Jehovah's. He will give you into my hand. I've got about 4 minutes. I'm not wanting to get into the next point. I want to, you know, just bait you and then entice you to come back next week. So once again, any thoughts, any comments before we conclude? Don't know. Like I say, the term youth can have reference to a child or to a man that has grown. We looked at Proverbs 5, rejoice in the wife of your youth. That's the same word. The term at the end of the chapter where Saul calls David a young man, that's the masculine form of Alma. Alma has reference to a mature woman, so indicates that he's a mature man. I wish I knew. I would just love to know how mature he was as he goes out to fight this battle against this giant.
But in land of Israel, wasn't a youth, a child supposed to be able to do his father's work by the age of 13. So he was a shepherding the flock. So can we assume that he was at least 12 or 13 years old?
That would sound reasonable. By the way, you're not allowed to ask questions that I can't answer. That's the ground rule here. I wish I could give you an answer, but that's a good thought. It's the fact that David is out watching the sheep. That is the responsibility, so perhaps he's 12 or 13 years old. But now, we don't know how much time has lapsed between chapter 16 and chapter 17. So there's could be a time period between that. Just don't know.
He had two older brothers, right?
So pardon?
He had two older brothers. His dad was real old himself.
Yes.
So he couldn't take care of the livestock. So he needed somebody to do that for him. That's why the youngest son probably did that.
Oh, it's interesting. That's David's gore. Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
In verse 38 of chapter 17, it says that David was able to put on Saul's armor. So he had a, regardless of age, he had to be a pretty stout, strong, whatever age he was, to be able to put on man's armor.
I have a mental picture of this little boy David only babbling brook, and he puts on Saul's shield and comes down about his ankles. Yeah, but that's a good point. I was going to make this comment about Eliab as David is going around asking people what's going to happen to the one that defeats him. Eliab says, why are you here, and who's watching the few sheep? And that's a put down to David. David's not watching him. You're just watching a few sheep. Okay, good. We get the battle next Wednesday evening. I thank you for your time and your attention this evening.